Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
We want to thank you for coming to the Tattered Cover this evening so that we can welcome folks like Kevin Anderson with his latest book, Clockwork Angels, which we have here. This book is about, for fans of Rush, the band, and fans here for that. Okay. This is the project that he described as when my kids were young and Sgt. Pepper's and some of those things came out. It would be like having the book then. It would be really cool. So this is very exciting. We're going to welcome him this evening to hear more about this wonderful new book.
I can't stop thinking big. That's a line from Clockwork Angels, and it also kind of sums up my life, some of the things. I grew up in a very small town like the character in Clockwork Angels. The town was called Franksville, Wisconsin, population 250. The main industry in town was the sauerkraut factory. So I grew up with the cabbage farmers all around growing cabbage and cabbage trucks driving by. That meant that all summer long, the sauerkraut factory made sauerkraut. And all winter long, the sauerkraut factory made sauerkraut. Except in the wintertime, they would dump all of the cabbage waste, the juice, the rotting debris into the ditches where it froze. And then in springtime, it would thaw. And then it would rot. And then it would have this delicious smell around the air of Franksville, Wisconsin. Now, I kind of come from a family of royalty because my mother was the sauerkraut queen of Franksville, Wisconsin in 1957. It was a very, very tiny town. All of my cousins lived nearby. It was kind of, I grew up basically in the movie The Christmas Story. That was like my life. But when I was about 5 years old, my parents let me watch The War of the Worlds, the original one. The Tom Cruise one doesn't count. Yes. I was 5 years old. Who knows why my parents let me watch that movie when I was 5 years old, but I couldn't sleep all night long. It was just in my head, this Martian invasion, the alien ships and the heat ray and the buildings collapsing. And at the end, after the Martians got the disease and died, and I'm sorry if that's a spoiler, but the movie was from like the 50s. And the book was from 1897. I just remember like the three-fingered hand crawling down the ramp of the ship, and it was all blotched with leprous blotches, and these Martians died because of germs in our air. And, you know, I was watching this movie smelling sauerkraut in the air, so I could understand how aliens might die from that. But I was so inspired by this movie, it was just burned me up inside. I really was interested in this stuff. So I wanted to tell stories like that, but I couldn't write because I was only 5 years old. So I got the notepad of paper beside the telephone book, and I drew little pictures of it, of, you know, the alien ships and the buildings collapsing and the three-fingered hand, and I'd lay them out on the ground, and anytime somebody would come by, I would stop them and I would tell the story of the War of the Worlds. So that was my first practice at doing graphic storytelling. And I just, that was it. I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to tell stories from the time I was 5 years old. Now, it would have helped if I learned how to read. And we were in this very small town that did have a sauerkraut factory, but it didn't have a library. We had the bookmobile. We had this little bookmobile, which was basically a large Winnebago filled with books that drove to the bank parking lot once a month. And I would ride my bike down, or I would ride the borrowed bike down, and go to the bookmobile, and I would check out one or two books, and I'd take them home and read them, and then the next time the bookmobile came by, I'd go back to the bookmobile, and I'd trade those in, and I'd get more. And the bookmobiles section of young adult books was like this big. So I went through that pretty quickly. And after I had finished all of those kids' books, I read every single one of them, then my eye started wandering to the adult bookstore. I mean, the adult section in the bookmobile. And I was seeing all these science fiction books that were there. And I wanted to read some of these science fiction books. There was Isaac Asimov and Arthur C. Clarke and Ray Bradbury in it. And I wanted to check them out. And I took one of them. It was called The Sands of Mars by Arthur C. Clarke. And I took it up to the desk where I wanted to check it out. Now, even though I haven't had any aspirations of becoming a medical professional, a surgeon, a doctor, I was 8 years old, and I diagnosed that that woman suffered from persistent hemorrhoids. She took one look at me, and she's looked at this book, and she said, "No, you can't check that out. That's for grown-ups only." Arthur C. Clarke. If you read it, there's like nothing in it at all. And so I went home pouting because I didn't get to check out any book. I had already read all the kids' books. And my mom noticed something was wrong, and she said, "You know, what's the matter? Why don't you have a book?" "The librarian wouldn't let me check out the book I wanted to." So my mom grabbed me by the arm and drove me back down to the bookmobile and marched me up the steps and into the bookmobile, and she went right up to the desk with hemorrhoid lady and said, "You let him check out whatever books he wants to." And so I got to go home with some books.
Yes.
But I still wanted to be a writer. I wanted to tell the stories of my own. I went into my dad's study, and he had a little manual typewriter in it, and he had pink paper from the scratch paper pile that it was like bright magenta. It was like Debbie's pants. That's the color of the paper it was. And I sat down, and I rolled one of those sheets of paper into the typewriter, and I plinked out my first novel when I was about 8.5 years old. It was called The Injection. It was about a mad scientist who creates an injection that can bring anything to life. But the other scientists don't believe him, so he goes on a rampage, because that's what mad scientists do. And he goes to the wax museum and brings all the wax figures to life. And then he goes to the Natural History Museum and brings all the dinosaur skeletons to life. And they go charging through the town and causing all kinds of mayhem. And he's riding on the back of a triceratops skeleton leading this huge army into town. And he made this fundamental mistake because he didn't realize, as most of you must realize, that triceratops skeletons, once reanimated, have a tendency to rear up at unexpected times. And so this one reared up right when he was under the electrical wires, and it electrocuted the mad scientist, and that was the end. I don't quite remember how all the monsters died, but I know he died that way. But that was my first novel when I was about 8 years old. And I started typing more stories. When I was, I think, 10 or 11, I had saved up enough allowance money that I could either buy my own bicycle, like a normal kid, or buy my own typewriter. And because I wanted to be a writer, I spent all the money I had saved up to buy my very own Smith Corona electric typewriter. And that's what I used to type story after story. I wrote a couple more slightly better novels on it. And I sent my stuff out when I was 12 years old. I got my very first rejection slip. Now, I told you how small this town was. It had the sauerkraut factory, but it didn't have a library. It had a bookmobile. And it also didn't have a record store. When I was, 12, 13, 14, I started getting into listening to music. At the time, there was Eagles, The Hotel California, Kansas, Carry On Wayward Son, Styx, Come Sail Away. There's other stuff. And I got a mailing for the Columbia Record Club. And the Columbia Record Club, I mean, this makes me feel old because none of this stuff happens anymore. But you would get these junk things in the mail for people who didn't have record stores nearby. And now what I'm realizing is these people are going, "What's a record store?" So even that is... But anyway, in the Columbia Record Club, it was like 15 albums for a dollar if you signed up for their club. And to pick the 15 albums, you got this sheet of stamps, little like postage stamps. And each one had an album cover on it, and you would peel off the ones that you wanted to get, and you'd paste them on this piece of paper with all 13 or 14 albums you got and send it in. Now, I wanted to get these albums, but... How many of you actually remember these, the Columbia Record Club? Okay. Whenever you got these things, Whenever you got them, there were like five albums that you really wanted. Then you went, well, what is all this other stuff? I don't even know what this other stuff is. Well, I put the ones down that I wanted. But then there was these other I had to fill up the sheet. And there were these other things. There was Alan Parsons' project, iRobot. And I thought, well, that sounds science fiction-y. Why not that? And since that one was on there, I figured, well, why not Alan Parsons' projects? He did an Edgar Allan Poe album, too. And these were the days when music, you could actually do stuff like that. And then there was this thing with this red star on it, and it had the numbers 2112. And I thought, that looked kind of interesting. That looked kind of science fiction-y. My mom said, he's naked. Which meant I had to get it then. But and there was A Farewell to Kings, which was a fantasy-based album that Rush had. And I just went, this is kind of cool, and Fly By Night. And I just put all the Rush albums that were there and all the Alan Parsons albums. I think there were other ones that I didn't quite make as good of a pick as those. But so I got these albums, and I started listening to them. And this stuff was really good. There was like these amazing, this wasn't an ooh, baby, baby, my girlfriend left me kind of songs. I was this nerdy kid with thick glasses, and I wish I had a girlfriend who would someday leave me, but I didn't even have the girlfriend. So all those songs were irrelevant to me. In fact, it was much more relevant, this dystopian society where a guy finds a guitar and learns how to play it, and then the priests kill him at the end. That was my life. So I listened to all these Rush songs, and they started inspiring all kinds of stories for me because these were just unabashed. I mean, Cygnus X-1, this guy gets in a ship and he flies off to the black hole to see what's inside the black hole, and the last line is he's sucked down into the black hole. And then you got to wait till the next album comes out to find out that he's in the land where all the Greek gods have gone. And I mean, this is cool stuff. I hope you think it's cool stuff. So that inspired a lot of things, and I kept writing stories, and I got them published, and then I got a job out in California where I was a technical writer for a research lab, which means I was writing really boring safety procedures, and I was writing filtration manuals, and I was doing posters about chemical experiments, but I was getting paid for writing, and that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a writer. And I would write my novels in the evening, or short stories and whatever. And as I was starting to work on and think about my first novel, a Rush album came out called Grace Under Pressure. And as I was thinking of the story in my novel, I was listening to the songs in Grace Under Pressure. And every one of those songs seemed to have something to do with the story that was developing in my head. So I thought, I like this. And I started playing the album with the intent of, how can I work this into my novel? I mean, there's a bunch of lines of, there's no swimming in the heavy water, there's no singing in the acid rain, and suddenly you were gone from all the lives you left your mark upon. And there's one about the android on the run, and there's... Well, another part of the story, but there's one, Are We the Last Ones Left Alive? It's a concentration camp story, but it was relevant to a whole bunch of the stuff in the story I was doing. So I wrote this novel called Resurrection Inc. It was my very first published novel, and everything in it I know comes from a part in the Rush album. So, of course, in the acknowledgments to the book, I said, and most of this novel was inspired by the Rush album Grace Under Pressure, and thanks to Geddy Lee, Alex Lifeson, and Neil Peart. And when the book came out, I signed a copy to Getty, one to Alex, and one to Neil. I packaged it up and I mailed it off to Mercury Records, which was kind of like sending something off to the warehouse with the Ark of the Covenant in it. And I wrote another book and got it published, and I wrote another book and got it published. And this had been like a year and a half since I sent the book in. And by that time, you give up hope. I mean, I didn't really expect anything anyway. But I had a particularly lousy day at work. I had some order had been screwed up, and I don't know, somebody didn't like a report that I had done. And then I got this notice from a science fiction magazine. I think it was Asimov Science Fiction Magazine or something, where they ran a review of my second or third novel and just ripped it to pieces. They hated it, trashed it. So this was like not the best day. And I came home and got the mail and opened it up. And I saw that there was bills for this and solicitations for that and a letter that had a return address, Neil Peart, on it. And there was a 7-page single-spaced letter from Neil about how much he liked my book. And it was no longer a sucky day. So I wrote him back, and we corresponded, and we have been corresponding for 23 years now. The first time I actually met him, I was living in Livermore, which is in the East Bay of San Francisco, and they were playing a concert in Sacramento, and I mailed him some maps, and he bicycled down from Sacramento, and he slept on my couch in my little townhouse that night. And then he invited me to the show, so I went backstage to the show. And this is like fanboy heaven. I mean, this is as cool. I have been backstage at every show from A Show of Hands until now, which means nothing if you're not a Rush fan, but that was a long time ago. That was a lot of albums. Neil used to take touring or do tours around Africa. He would bicycle around Africa. This guy all by himself riding through Africa and going past checkpoints with guards and Uzis and things. And I'm sure his fans and his insurance company didn't like that, but that's what he did. And he would write up journals about all this stuff, and he would send me his journals about all these trips he took through Africa, and he would describe everything so very vividly about these weird towns he would go to, little villages in the absolute back of beyond. And in the mid-90s, I got invited to write a short story for an anthology called Shock Rock, which were all creepy horror stories that had something to do with rock music. And so I wrote the editor and said, would you mind if I wrote my story with the drummer from Rush? And he said, no, he wouldn't mind if I wrote the story with... And I did a short story about a rock drummer who goes around Africa and encounters a particularly weird town where they make drums using human skins on the heads. And I basically took all of the description from all of Neil's journals and just put it all in there. And I sent Neil his half of the first paycheck, which the whole story paid me $250, so I sent him his $125, and he assured me he wasn't going to quit drumming anytime soon. That story's called Drum Beats, and you can get it as an ebook now. We've had it up for sale if you want to download that one. But we've always thought about doing something much, much bigger and much more interesting, because all of these Rush albums just keep inspiring stories. I mean, there's been countless stories of mine that come from something. In fact, their song Red Sector A, the concentration camp song that I worked into Grace Under Pressure, that one has also worked its way into probably like 5 of my things. And Rebecca and I went up to see the concert that they were having for, was it the R30 tour? I'm sorry, we've been backstage at so many tours, you can't remember. So we get to see what's called the sound trick, which means the band plays about 4 or 5 songs to an entirely empty amphitheater except for me and Rebecca sitting there. And Rebecca was reading one of my manuscripts, I think A Forest of Stars from the Seven Sons books. And in there's like a breeding camp, a concentration camp where these humans are taken and held prisoner and by aliens, yes. And she's reading this book, and they're doing sound check, and they play Red Sector A, and I read the last one, and she's going, they're singing, and Rebecca just turns and looks to me, and she says, how many stories are you going to get out of that song? Well, anyway, I was sitting up in my I have a cabin in Estes Park where I like to go and just hole up and do a lot of writing and get uninterrupted. And it was about 2.5 years ago that while I was up in that cabin, Neil wrote me and said, so what about this stuff called steampunk? It's really interesting, but do you think it's going to still be around in a year or two? And I wrote him, and he said, well, I think so. Steampunk is kind of like Jules Verne and hot air balloons and steam engines and clockwork stuff. And I said, I think it'll be around. I didn't know what he was asking. I said, I think it'll be around. I think it's very cool. I mean, it's been around since Jules Verne, and it's still there. And then he said, because he's got this idea for this big, epic concept album that's kind of got a steampunk background to it, that's got a watchmaker, and he had this image in his head about this weird steampunk carnival and our and a bad guy called the Anarchist and our hero. There's this point where there's a bomb at the carnival and the Anarchist has planted it, but the hero is the one that gets the bomb, but everybody blames him for it, and then he's off on the run. And that's where he was starting with this. And I said, yeah, that sounds kind of cool. You always have to encourage Neil, of course, if he needs it. And he started talking more and more about it and developing some of the songs. And then they recorded two songs, Caravan and BU2B, which they used as the basis for a tour called The Time Machine, which was a very steampunky tour that they went around with. And this was an overall story, but, okay, I write like 8 books a year. Rush does an album like every 5 years. So our work speeds were like not quite the same. But I let him just develop and do what he needed to do. And they did their two songs through the Time Machine tour, and they came out to Red Rocks to play. It was a Monday and a Wednesday, I think, were the two shows that they played. So he stayed with us in between the two shows. And in between the two shows, I took him up on his first 14er. We climbed Mount Evans. And while we climbed Mount Evans, we were plotting this whole story for Clockwork Angels. And so there are lots of gasping breaths going on, but that's where we came up with a whole bunch of the story. In fact, I should go a little bit earlier. As he was developing it, Rebecca and I had lunch with him in Santa Monica. And he was going on about how excited he was about this story and that they were talking about this big, beautiful stage show, and someday it was going to be a Broadway musical, and there was going to be a novel, and there were going to be Ice Follies. And I was going, okay, cool. And then Rebecca just did the novel. Who's going to write the novel? And Neil said, well, Kevin is, of course. So we plotted it and put it together, and it was just a real lot of fun getting the lyrics as he wrote them and figure out how the story would gel and filling in the blanks and developing the world and sending things back. And then Neil would send some of the ideas off to Hugh Syme, who was the artist who has painted every Rush cover since 2112. And Hugh would paint images from it and said, how about this? And it would go back and I'd look at the painting he would do and go, wow, I've got to go back and rewrite that scene and expand everything in it. In fact, Hugh is the one who was reading the pieces about the watchmaker and realized that the honeybee was the perfect symbol for the watchmaker. So I went back and I had to put all that stuff in because it was so perfect. And anyway, I love that story. It's really just like a steampunk version of Candide, which is one of Neil's favorite books, and that's kind of where the basis of it is. And the book, this was funny, the book is a beautiful book. Even if you don't buy it, and I hope you buy it, but you have to at least look at it because there hasn't been a book like this for a long time. It's full color throughout. The design is beautiful. The printing is beautiful. It's a Canadian publisher that has published Neil's other stuff before, and this was the biggest thing that they had ever published. And we spent 2 weeks on the New York Times extended list on this. It was the publisher's first bestseller ever. So I had to lead them. They didn't even know it. I'm the one who found out because all of my editors wrote me and said, congratulations, you made the list. So I wrote to the publisher and said, why didn't you tell me we made the list? And they said, we made the list? It was also Neil's first New York Times bestseller, and we made the list exactly on his 60th birthday. So I was able to text him just before he went on stage to do, I think it was a New Hampshire concert they had that night. So he got to drum knowing he was a New York Times bestselling author then, which I'm sure impresses him because he's had no other accomplishments whatsoever in his life. Let me just spend a second talking about the other book that I'm here for tonight. Does somebody have a death warmed over in the audience that I can show up? Yes, there. This is something that I've also had a huge amount of fun doing, because I always write these giant epic science fiction books, these big serious Dune books, serial killer books. Even Clockwork Angels is a very serious coming of age and colorful steampunk thing. But this is fun. This is about Dan Shamble, zombie PI. It's a zombie private detective. He solves cases in the monster part of town. He's got a bleeding heart human lawyer as his partner. They solve, like, for instance, there is a the Jekyll Lifestyle Products and Necroceuticals company that makes deodorant and shampoos and toothpaste for the monsters. They have a line of lip gloss specifically for zombies called Embalm. One of their batches of shampoo for vampires was accidentally contaminated with garlic oil, so all the vampires' hair fell out. So then they're being class action lawsuit. There are two witches, sisters, that have used a supposed romance spell out of a spell book, but there is a misprint, so the spell went horribly wrong, and one of the sisters got turned into a big fat pig. And so they're suing the publisher for not running a spell check. There is a skittish vampire who's sure that somebody's trying to kill him because he sees wooden stakes everywhere and he knows that they're for him. Miranda Jekyll is trying to get a divorce from Harvey Jekyll, but they can't break the prenuptial agreement. And, well, I mean, there's just a million little stories and cases. And it starts out with, I'm dead, it happens, but I'm still ambulatory and I can still solve cases. And so he's also got to solve his own murder, who killed him. And his girlfriend is a ghost, and he's also working on who killed her. And this is the first book that just came out. The second one comes out in like 3 weeks, called Unnatural Acts. The third one comes out in May, so I've got three all out in rapid succession. And these really are just funny, laugh-out-loud, one-after-another things. So thank you for being the stage master there. I have three door prizes, but I will take some questions if anybody has any questions. Yes, sir.
So I haven't read the book yet. I'm just picking it up tonight.
Yeah, Darth Vader is Luke's father. That's what you find.
Sorry. Spoiler alert.
There are kids in the audience. Come on.
Pat, I need those.
But having listened to the Rush album, the Wreckers, uh-huh. In particular, the imagery in it sounds really familiar to Isaac Storm, about the hurricane scene there and Human Chain. And I was wondering if there was any influence from any nonfiction books like Isaac Storm in the writing of this.
That I don't know. There was a Daphne du Maurier, was it Smuggler's Cove or something, where they would lure ships. They would like put the lighthouse in the wrong place so the ships would get run up against the rocks. And Neil said that was always sort of this romantic thing from the du Maurier book, because they would wreck the ships and then they would take all the cargo, and that's how they would make their living. But he was realizing that must have really sucked if you were aboard one of those ships. And so there's that, and there's the Seven Cities of Gold, which is based on all of the, you know, the Cibola and El Dorado myths in America. And he wrote this song called The Garden, which is the last one on the album. And as he wrote it, he was writing me letters saying, you know, I think this is really good. I think this is one of the most beautiful songs I've ever written. And we were just at the Anaheim concert, and there were people in tears all around us on it. And that's a very moving song. And in fact, how many of you are Rush fans? Okay. Yeah. Well, the reason I ask it is because while we were at this concert, you know, you're in the concert and everybody's standing around, everybody's cheering and stuff. And I don't even remember what song it was. I think it was. It wasn't The Pass, which is what I thought. But this guy next to me, he was, you know, kind of doing the rocking out thing for the whole time. And this is this song going on. And I just turned over, And I looked at him, and he was doing this, and he had tears just pouring down his face. And I tweeted this afterward, and I said that I saw this guy, and I said, Rush fans get this. That there is so much in it that speaks to so many people in its own way. And there have been so many things that I have gotten out of the lyrics that I found afterward, well, that wasn't what Neil intended at all. Yeah. But it got me that way. And there's their song called Mission is my favorite song of theirs, because it just speaks to creative inspiration and the people who don't have that creative inspiration don't even know what they don't have. And it kind of speaks to how you've heard the cliche of all the writers, and we give the talks, and somebody always raises their hand, and I'm sorry if you were going to do this, but they always raise their hand and go, where do you get your ideas? And I'm always polite, because Rebecca always tells me to be polite, but I have always thought, I don't understand that question. How do the rest of you stop them from coming? I mean, I've always got ideas, and it must be very strange to not have ideas. And that's kind of what that song is about, and that has nothing to do with your question. I'm sorry. But Debbie?
How do you feel about sauerkraut these days?
I actually like sauerkraut. I didn't like it growing up. I don't like it on ice cream.
It smells up the whole house.
But good sauerkraut. Good sauerkraut is good stuff. Okay. Yes?
In the book, you have the character of the anarchist. I was wondering, is that kind of based on the professor from Secret Agent, Joseph Conrad's work? Because I saw a lot of similarities.
Partly. He was a big Conrad fan. But he had the anarchist, and this was one of the things that we developed during the mountain climb of Mount Evans, that he had the watchmaker, who's kind of like Big Brother, who controls everything. But I think it's kind of unusual and unique in a sense, in that this is the Big Brother, the repressive guy, but he's really not all that bad. I mean, he really is got a pretty nice system going up, and most people are happy, and most people are healthy, and most people are taken care of. And it's just when you're kind of pushing the envelope and you want to do something else that you run up against it. But then you have an anarchist, which is the freedom extremist, the guy that thinks everybody should be free to do anything they want. And there are most people that I know of really don't want that kind of freedom. They actually like to know that the lights will turn on when you flick the light switch, and they like to know that when they go to the airport their flight will be on time, and they like to know that there is a structure and a framework in place. And here's a guy who just wants to get rid of all of it. And we were working on that as a way that basically the two extremes are too much. You got to figure out some way that it's not going to be one or the other, and I don't want to mess up the book or anything for people, but he does die in the end, and there's no. Yes, in the back.
Will there be any more Dune books?
Yes, there will be more Dune books. The next one is called Mentats of Dune, and we've already written it. We're just editing it right now. The last one was, previous one was Sisterhood of Dune, and that's a trilogy, so there will be three of those books. Brian and I are doing, 13 Dune books now, and Mentats, I think, is the 14th one. We also started our own trilogy called Hellhole, which is an original science fiction thing. So we did the first Hellhole book, and then we did Sisterhood of Dune. And the second Hellhole book, called Hellhole Awakening, comes out in the end of February or early March. So that one's already written. It's all in production now. And then the one after that, these will come out every year, but the so we're looking at spring of 2014 for Mentats of Dune. They'll be every other year. I know that sounds a long time, but if you're a George Martin fan, it does not sound like a long time at all.
Talk about your process, both real quick, and how you write with Brian, and how that differed with Neil. And then also, just doing the math in my head, what do you do, about 1.5 million words a year?
Yeah. About 1.5 million words a year.
Yeah.
I just wrote, how many of you have read my Saga of Seven Sons books, any of those? I just did a new book, a new trilogy in that series. And it's about 1,000 pages long, and I wrote it in 7 weeks. That was a headlong flight for a first draft. There's I'm editing it now, but that was getting the words down was about 1,000 words or 1,000 pages in 7 weeks. And that, I believe that's my personal best. I mean, I don't think I've ever done that much that fast, but it was just a full steam ahead writing between 4,000 and 8,000 words a day and going. And I do it with a digital recorder. I'll go hiking and I will just dictate the stuff instead of sitting in my office to type it. And for this one, I was writing so fast, our typing service had, I think, 3 or 4 full-time typists just transcribing my stuff. For the collaboration that we do, Brian and I, or Rebecca and I, when we do it together, we'll brainstorm the whole book together, we'll outline it, we'll massage the outline back and forth, and then we divide the chapters in half, and we each write our own chapters, and then we swap them and rewrite each other's chapters and keep going. And we've been married 21 years and done 35 books together. Not me and Brian, me and me. But with Neil, we talked about it all the way through, and he had the all the lyrics. He was feeding me the story piece by piece as it came through. But I did all of the actual words on the page, except for a few scenes in there. There's a steampunk robotic drummer doing things, and I just said, Neil, you have to write the part with the drummer. So he writes the part with the drummer. And there were other things that he put in. But I was writing probably 2 chapters a day, first draft of this. And whenever I would get the chapters back, I would read through them once to clean them up. And I'd email them to Neil. So he was receiving like 1 or 2 chapters every single day. And then he was commenting and how about this and adding that. And he was really into this alchemy stuff too. So he was researching it and adding all kinds of that back to me back and forth. And we were doing up to 14, 15 emails a day, just back and forth. And there's one character in there called Guerrero, who is a kid he bumps into in Poseidon City. That's like a chapter and a half that's in there. And Neil had this idea for expanding that part of the story, and he wanted this character in there, and he was telling me all about him, and he told me that in the morning, and I sent him those chapters by the afternoon.
So while they're trying to put the finishing touches on the album as well.
Yeah. Well, that's why I did most of the stuff. And we've got one more question.
Just very quickly, how did you make the transition from keyboard to dictation? Did that happen all at once, or?
I was never really good at sitting with my butt still in a chair and having to make up. I used to go out. When I would be stuck on a story, like how do I fix this part or who do this character, I would go out for a walk and just think about it. And then I started carrying a tape recorder to just dictate my notes. And then my notes of, like, say, outlining a space battle, my notes would be so detailed that it was basically a first draft. And I realized that I much preferred writing while I was out walking and seeing things. And this was at a time when people didn't really have cell phones, so I was like this homeless guy wandering around muttering to myself. But that's the way I do it, and I think everything since my third book, and I've published 121 books now, have all been at least mostly dictated. A round of thanks to our 501st this year.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.